and welcome to the AYO podcast. My name is Simone and I'm joined by my colleague Katie. Today we'll be chatting to conductor Courtney Lewis ahead of our two spectacular concerts at Sydney Town Hall and QPAC in Brisbane over the next few days.
That's right, and Courtney has joined us today to give us a brief run through of the amazing repertoire we'll be hearing at these concerts, and hopefully for those of us who'll be sat in the audience, we'll learn a little something to help us enjoy the music even more. Great to have you here, Courtney. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's lovely to be with you as well.
So tell us, how have rehearsals been going this week?
They've been wonderful. So this is day three, and we've had a lot of rehearsals each day. The orchestra's playing really well and rising to the challenge of this quite adventurous program.
And the first piece is Britten's Symphonia del Requiem. Could you just give a little bit of background on this piece?
Sure. Britten wrote this piece in the late 1930s. He was living in New York at that time in a wonderfully bohemian household of Christopher Isherwood, W.H. Auden, and him in Brooklyn. And he was still a relatively unknown composer, but for some reason, we're not quite sure why, he was commissioned by the Japanese government to write a piece for the 2600th anniversary of the ruling dynasty there. And he responded with a piece which is really quite strange for that kind of commission, Sinfonia del Requiem. It's in three movements, each of which has a title from the Requiem Mass. So we have a Lacrimosa, then a Dies Irae, and then a Requiem Aeternam. It's a bleak piece. I mean, it's a reflection of the uncertainty that was in Europe and in the world generally in the late 1930s as war was looming. And the fact that he chose to write a piece which is based on a text like Day of Wrath, Day of Mourning, when man and heaven turns to ash, as a celebration, you know, for a Japanese government is very peculiar. And of course, they thought so too and rejected the piece. Britten was terribly upset, although I'm not quite sure why he was surprised. But the New York Philharmonic and the English conductor, Sir John Barbarolli, who was then its music director, gave the first performance in New York. His music from that time is some of my favorite of all. There's a much more sort of deliberate modernism to the style than there is in his works post-1945, post-Peter Grimes. So the first movement seems to be mourning something, as you would expect with the title Lacrimosa. And it builds to an absolutely terrifying climax with the orchestra playing in D major and D minor at the same time, which is a very unsettling psychological feeling. And the second movement, Dies Irae, is like a dance of death. This is very much wartime music, and it's very frightening, the kind of Shostakovich kind of atmosphere. And then the third movement, Requiem Aeternam, which is a text that we usually associate with some kind of resolution and hope and light for the future, does give us something of that, but it's a very ambivalent piece of music, and we leave not quite sure if we've really arrived in somewhere which is actually full of hope. So it's a complicated piece, and that's quite fun to do with the youth orchestra, because there's a lot to talk about and a lot to explore, both in the musical meaning but also in the psychological background to it all.
After the Britten, we then go into the Tchaikovsky, which is one of the most famous concertos in the repertoire of classical music. Are you really excited to conduct that piece and then also have Andre come and perform it with the Australian Youth Orchestra?
I am. I'm looking forward to hearing his interpretation, because it's a piece that I've conducted probably too many times already. But of course, it's a wonderful piece. It's one of the pieces of music that I remember as a child, my father playing, and that first wonderful melody that begins in the strings after the thundering chords of the piano at the start. It's a piece that's impossible to resist. I think it's a wonderful piece for people who maybe haven't come to a concert before to come and hear something that's so accessible and so joyful. So I'm looking forward to it. It's always amazing how different soloists bring completely different ideas to a piece. And as a conductor, it's very exciting to be introduced to those new ideas and to reimagine the piece afresh with each soloist.
I was going to ask you about this, actually. So obviously, you're up there by yourself a lot of the time. When you suddenly have a soloist come into the picture, how does that work? Could you sort of talk a little bit about that process, sort of sharing your stage with a soloist? Mm-hmm. How does that work?
Of course, it's collaborative. And, you know, it depends. If you have a very famous soloist, you know, who's much older than you, much more experienced, you defer completely to his or her ideas. The opposite way around if you're working with a student or somebody at the very beginning. But I always try to find as much collaboration as possible. But you do have to adjust, because, of course, one prepares a piece and has lots of ideas and, you know, conductors aren't shy in expressing their opinions usually and their thoughts on how a piece should go. So there's a degree of collaboration and of compromise in that. Of course, there are lots of parts of the piece when it's just the orchestra as well. So there's a great deal of interpretive flexibility there as well.
Yeah, sharing.
Yeah.
A bit of sharing. So our programme closes with another Russian work. Now, Rachmaninoff, we know, had a little mid-career break. And he came back after that and composed his symphonic dances. Could you perhaps, would you say it's a little different to his earlier works? Could you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, well, there is this big difference of style between Rachmaninoff's late music and his early pieces. When I say the late pieces, I mean the Rhapsody on Theme of Paganini, the Fourth Piano Concerto, the Third Symphony, the Symphonic Dances. He had a quite major psychological break when he was relatively young. His first symphony was a complete failure. It was conducted by Glazunov, who was very drunk at the first performance.
Brilliant.
But also, it's not his finest piece. He hadn't quite figured out how to make melodies seamless. So the failure of that first symphony really was a problem for him. He came back, of course, and the second symphony is one of his most popular works, full of wonderful melodies and a great piece. The second symphony, though, was also quite typical of his early style in that it's very long and meandering. And as a conductor, it's quite difficult to make it cohesive. You can get stuck very easily because there are so many opportunities to take lots of time and the piece can really become sprawling. But as he got older and as you get into the 1930s, there's a much greater concentration in his composition. Perhaps it was the influence of the neoclassicism that was so much in style at that time. He certainly felt left behind, particularly as a Russian composer in the age of Stravinsky. You know, from the teens onwards, Stravinsky was the guy that everybody wanted to hear. And of course, he was very disparaging about Rachmaninoff. He once called him a 7-foot Russian scowl.
Charming.
Yeah. So in the later works, you feel this much tighter formal concentration, and that's particularly the case in the symphonic dances. It's also his last piece. He'd been ill, and he was recovering in 1940 on Long Island, the island south of New York. And he was very homesick. You know, he was deeply Russian. He was religious as an Orthodox Christian. And he had this obsession with certain plain chants, particularly the Dies Irae. We hear it in the Third Piano Concerto, also in the Rachmaninoff Paganini variations. And the First Symphony, that piece that I mentioned at the very beginning, has a melody which is based on the first three notes of the Dies Irae. And in the Symphonic Dances, Rachmaninoff actually takes that melody and rehabilitates it, gives it a second chance. It was the one thing that he thought was worth saving from the First Symphony. So the end of the first movement of the Symphonic Dances quotes this beautiful melody, and we feel a sense of full circle coming. Then in the last movement, the Dies Irae references become stronger and stronger, and so we can't escape them. But he does something very beautiful. Right after we hear the Dies Irae in the full orchestra, he gives the trumpets another plain chant, and he actually writes the words of it above in the score, which is just Alleluia. And I find that unbelievably moving, that after a lifetime of being obsessed with a very dark and unpleasant plain chant, you know, the Day of Judgment, that he was able to find a way of incorporating something that's so much more optimistic. And that was his last thing that he said as a composer. And I think that's a wonderful message to leave the concert with.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you've all been working incredibly hard, and we're also looking forward to hearing the two concerts on Saturday the 14th of July at Sydney Town Hall and on Monday the 16th of July at QPAC in Brisbane. There are still a few tickets available if you're interested. Head to ayo.com.au for more details. Courtney, it's been a pleasure to have you on the podcast today, and best of luck for the concert.
Thank you very much.
That's all from us. Until next time.